Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The legislative redistricting process in Ohio remains in limbo, awaiting another Supreme Court ruling on previously rejected maps. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us this week, Anna Staver, State House reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Daryl Rowland, senior editor with the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. We survived the blood moon eclipse.
I know. And a heck of a thunderstorm last night to boot. And Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann.
So, Andy, that means you get to answer the question. The Supreme Court already has ruled against these maps that are now before them. So I guess it won't be a big surprise if they rule against them again.
Right. Yeah. So these were maps that, just to get everybody up to speed, we're talking about the state legislative districts. That's 99 seats in the Ohio House, 33 seats in the Ohio Senate, and a group called the Ohio Redistricting Commission is drawing these new state legislative district maps. They've drawn four other maps in the past, and they've all been rejected by the Ohio Supreme Court. On this fifth go-around, they decided to resubmit what's been known as Map 3. This is a map that was passed in February and rejected in March by the Ohio Supreme Court. They resubmitted these maps because their argument, they're Republicans on the Ohio Redistricting Commission, are arguing that this is the only map that can be used in order to be able to hold a primary on August 2nd in order for the local boards of elections to hit all their deadlines.
Because they're kind of ready.
Yeah, because they're kind of ready because this was a map that was already in the process of being implemented before it was shut down by the redistricting commission or by the Ohio Supreme Court. So some of the deadlines that have already been hit using these maps before they were rejected. So the Ohio Supreme Court, is expected to reject these maps again because they already rejected it in March. And the problem here, according to the Ohio Supreme Court, is that the maps do reflect proportionality. So in Ohio, you have about 54% of the state who's voting for Republican, 46% of the state voting Democratic. And that map reflects that proportionality by percent. But there is a large portion of those Democratic districts that are more like toss-up districts. So of the, I think, 45 Ohio House districts that could be considered Democratic districts, a third of them are toss-ups. So a third of those districts could sway towards the Republicans. The Ohio Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional.
So what happens? So if the Supreme Court rejects it, then it's gonna go to a federal court that's going to decide what's going to happen in August.
Yeah, so looming over all of this is a federal court decision that says if the Ohio Supreme Court and the Ohio Redistricting Commission cannot see eye to eye on constitutional maps, then the federal court will step in and they will implement a map. The map that they've chosen to implement, if nothing else happens, is that map, Map 3 that we're talking about, the one that's already been rejected by the Ohio Supreme Court. So in essence, the federal court is ready to implement an unconstitutional map by May 28th if no other maps are adopted from now until then.
What happens to the congressional and legislative maps after the general? Are they in place for 2 years again, or does the Redistricting Commission have to go back to the drawing board again?
We all want to know. We all want to know.
Oh, this
what's up
is
next.
The mystery of okay.
So the if the federal court ruling is what ends up happening, if May 28th comes around and the federal court implements Map 3, then a primary will likely be held on August 2nd using those maps using those districts that were created by Map 3. Now, while all that is going on, there's still an argument that's being made as to what the Ohio Redistricting Commission should be doing. Should they still be working to create another round of new state legislative maps to be used for the 2024 cycle? And most voting rights advocates groups, community organizations, a national Democratic group, they're all saying that even if that deadline, that May 28th deadline were to come and go, and a map is implemented for this special election in August, that the Ohio Redistricting Commission should still be working to create new congressional districts and new state legislative districts. But the Republicans, especially Republicans on the Ohio Redistricting Commission, are arguing that nothing should be done from now, from that federal court deadline until the November general election to decide who is actually in the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate at that point, because that could determine new members of the Ohio Redistricting Commission. Sort of like a lame duck situation, wondering who's going to be in power then and who could be making the shots after the general election.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, also with us. Anna Staver, Statehouse reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Daryl Rowland, senior editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Daryl, what about plans to change the process at its root? I mean, what's the likelihood that voters could in the future return to the ballot box and decide to amend the Constitution again, like they did in 2015 and 2018?
Well, I think two things, Anne. Number one, I think there's probably going to be a sense that at this point in the game, let's let this process play out and, you know, see where we end up with this when, if we ever get through these interminable court battles and the political mud fights and all that good stuff. But two, I think there's there's extremely wide dissatisfaction with this. And of course, whoever loses these internal battles will be especially motivated to go back to voters and change that. And just, you know, I haven't seen polling or anything on this, but I think just the sense, at least that I get from where I sit, is there's an overall sentiment to remove politicians maybe from the process. You can't remove politics from the process because it is an inherently political mm-hmm. process, of course. And one thing we haven't talked about, Ann, is, you know, there's a third set of spinning plates out there, and that's contempt of court.
Yeah, no, yes, yes. The Ohio Organizing Collaborative has filed a motion on that score.
Well, and basically almost all the, if you will, the Democratic sides. And for the first time, interestingly, the two Democratic members of the Redistricting Commission, 7-member commission, 5 R's, 2 D's, mm-hmm. Allison Russo, Vernon Sykes. For the first time, they have sought contempt. Some of the other groups have sought it a couple of times before. And frankly, there's once, as Andy said, you know, once the federal court said, if you guys can't solve this on your own, basically Republicans win, there was not much motivation for Republicans to do much. And indeed, I don't think it's a biased statement. They did nothing, essentially. They were given 22 days to come up with a solution, with new maps. They did not even meet until the 20th day. And then they went back to a map that was already found unconstitutional. We're almost at the stage like, all right, make us.
Well, I mean, we're at that point, wouldn't you say, Anna Staver? I mean, we've got Bill Seitz going kind of nah, your Republican, prominent Republican lawmaker, kind of like in your face now.
Yeah, it seems to be the general consensus amongst the Republicans that the federal court is going to implement the third map, and that's what they're going to do. I mean, they were asked to create a new map, and they essentially sent the old one back to the court. And I think that does raise a question of, is that contempt? To sort of say, you declared this unconstitutional, but we think we're going to get this map, so we're not going to do anything else. But the big question with contempt of court that I think we've all had is, how far do they go? Do they fine the members? Do they bring them down to the court to explain? They had started to do that a couple months ago, and then they backed down. And it's quite an incredible thing, because the Ohio Redistricting Commission has the governor of the state of Ohio on it. And so are we going to hold him in contempt of court and drag him down and start fining him? Like, contempt in a lay set, like, amongst us can mean imprisonment. Like, I don't think they're going to go that far, but like, what is the court going to do that would actually be a punishment?
And the argument has been made by Republicans on the Ohio Redistricting Commission that the Supreme Court does not have the authority to hold them in contempt because, as they argue, the Ohio Redistricting Commission is a separate branch of government. You have legislators on there. You have members of the executive branch on there. And their argument is that that would be a violation of separation of powers. But then on the flip end of that, you are able to impeach a sitting member of the Ohio Supreme Court. The legislature is able to sort of check that balance on one end, but what power does the judicial branch have to check their power on the other end?
Mm-hmm. They've never really tested it, have they?
No, not. And so we've talked about this a lot, the DeRolf case where
the school funding case. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And 30 years later, not that I'm counting.
The Ohio Supreme Court has found that the state's school funding situation is unconstitutional, yet nothing, there is no...
teeth?
Yeah, there's no teeth behind it. There's no enforcement of it in any
no
way.
Imperative,
where,
yeah.
So, like, they've said, yes, what you're doing is unconstitutional, and then has just left it at that.
I mean, big picture, this is about our whole democratic system. You know, when a court says you must do something, and it is indeed the final authority... In the jurisdiction, in this case, the Ohio Supreme Court was given that authority in the constitutional amendment we all approved as Ohio voters. Mm-hmm. If they say do this and they say not gonna, what does happen? I mean, people call this a constitutional crisis, and I guess it kind of is. And it's a collision of, you know, the very tops of our differing branches of government, the top legislators, the governor, a couple elected officials, and the Supreme Court. There you are. There's our system of checks and balances all running head on into the middle, and not sure what we're going to happen. Hey, here's this is for your listeners. Daryl's weird thought of the day. So let's just take it on that issue of jurisdiction, the authority of the court, and all that, and remove the merits of yay or nay on redistricting. Is there any chance at all that the justices who have been against the majority on the redistricting decisions would say, yeah, we didn't agree with those decisions, but that doesn't give you the right to disobey it. So you can't just flaunt the Supreme Court, a majority opinion of the Supreme Court, and just escape willy-nilly with no consequences. Again, what those consequences are is up in the air. But I just wonder, wouldn't it be incredible if it was a 6-1 or 7-0 decision to find them in contempt? Okay, end of Daryl's weird thought.
Wouldn't it have to be 6-0, though, because Pat DeWine is on the court?
He'd have
to
recuse himself.
Yeah, to lock up his dad.
Well, didn't they substitute?
They do substitute, and he has said that he would recuse himself if it came to that situation.
Yeah, and the last time they did, he did, and there was a visiting judge appointed to replace him. Right.
And you have had a sitting Supreme Court Justice Republican Sharon Kennedy, who's running for Chief Justice, who has said that she disagrees with the call of contempt. So there's even members of the Ohio Supreme Court who have said that they're not sure, or they disagree with the possibility that it has the authority to do that.
So Republicans on the Redistricting Commission have used the tactic of delay to get what they want.
Yes.
It's pretty clear.
No question.
Could they do that as well to avoid any kind of retribution or any kind of consequences, wait until the Chief Justice is retired, you know, and her term expires at the end of the year?
Absolutely. And I think Anna and Andy have already...
As far as the contempt issues go and all of that.
Well, and on the big picture, about two-year map, and when do you start?
It won't be the same set of factors after December 31st.
Right. Or January 1st or whatever, right the beginning of next year. The new Chief Justice is either going to be Jennifer Bruner or Sharon Kennedy. Now, the loser will still remain on the Supreme Court, so it doesn't affect the partisan balance, but there are two races for Supreme Court, obviously a Democrat and Republican in each race. It is 4-3 Republican right now. If Democrats would take one of those seats, that would really change the equation.
You know, what's the likelihood, though, that reporters are paying enough attention to all of this to make this a strategy when they go to the ballot box in...
For voters?
Absolutely. It totally is.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already seen this. Remember, they changed the legislation. We're not going to have party labels.
Yeah, yeah.
For Ohio Supreme
They're
Court
counting
candidates.
At it. Yeah.
And I think part of that was Republicans saying, dang, we lost that one.
How'd that happen?
If only Judy French, Justice Judy French, had Republican after her name, she would not have lost. You know, and Jennifer Bruner would not be on the Supreme Court.
Huh.
Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But at least that's my take on that legislation. Yeah, this is preserving power.
And your question is basically going to be the next big question. If and when this federal court ruling does take place, the next big question is, what happens next procedurally? So this is a little bit of a game of hypotheticals, but this is based on past rulings. The Ohio Supreme Court has said this map is unconstitutional. We're going to give you a deadline. And basically 10 days out, 14 days out, 22 days out. So this resubmitted third map could be found unconstitutional by the Ohio Supreme Court. And they may give the redistricting commission a deadline to come up with a sixth set of state legislative district maps. That deadline could be before the federal court May 28th deadline or afterwards. And if it's afterwards, then we're looking at the 2024 season. And then this game of back and forth keeps going for a while. Yeah.
And you know, still pending, even though we just voted in congressional primaries, there's a court challenge with the Ohio Supreme Court still pending on those congressional districts. Now, I don't think they're going to, you know, rip through out the results and have to have another congressional primary. I mean, in theory, that's possible, but that would be dubious.
Right.
But yeah, but you know, if that's ruled unconstitutional for what, it'd be second time, right? Just for
third.
If this
for congressional. Yeah, yes. Even us reporters who cover this. God help you folks trying to, you right. Virtuous folks who listen to Ann's show. But yeah, multiple times on congressional. And yeah, you'd have to say the odds are they probably will, because the latest congressional map that's currently before the court has many of the defects that the majority right. of the court cited in its first decision. So what happens with that? Do we play the waiting game on that? Whatever. But yeah, I think the big game will be then put everything off till after the election. Republicans will roll the dice on, our candidates, Justices DeWine and Fisher will prevail against their Democratic challengers. We'll have that mean old Marine Connor off the court, and Republicans will have a true 4-3 majority.
We will continue our conversation. You're listening to our weekly reporter roundtable. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. After millions of Americans lost their homes to foreclosure in the Great Recession, investment groups in the U.S. and abroad swooped in to gobble up the real estate at cash-on-the-barrelhead bargain basement rates. They raised rents, trimmed costs, and have since priced out ordinary home buyers, leaving some formerly primarily owner-occupied communities riddled with rental properties. An Ohio bill would change that equation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Darrell Rowland, senior editor with the Columbus Dispatch, and Anna Staver, State House reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Anna, give us a thumbnail on just what numbers are we talking about when it comes to these homes that are now owned by investment firms everywhere from here to Tokyo?
Yeah, so it really depends on the community, which I thought was really interesting in my reporting. So you look at an area like the Columbus area, which includes like Franklin and parts of Delaware as you kind of like go around that bubble. And it was about 16% of homes, single family homes, are rental. But you go up to but if you look into the individual neighborhoods, so some of the more majority minority neighborhoods are looking at 30, 40. Down in Cincinnati, I saw one that was like 50%. And so it seems to be these lower, like entry-level homes, the lower end of the market is what's really getting scooped up, because they're often bought in foreclosure. So, you know, like those auctions that the sheriff's auctions do on houses. And so what a lot of these companies do, which you and I probably, well, we definitely cannot do, is they go in and they'll say, I'll buy 30 houses, and they set a price. And, you know, and it's all cash. There's no inspection. There's no contingencies. And, you know, to a bank, I'm sure that looks great. We just moved 30 homes off our books.
Right.
But to individuals, I'm like, I can't buy 29 more properties.
Right. And then they can sit on it if they have to. It's not.
Yeah. And there are some rules. So the legislation that was introduced here in Ohio is actually modeled after a California bill. And I did tease the Republican introducing it a little bit about that fact. But that one also allowed communities to have more teeth when they go to enforce, say, vacant or houses that aren't having the lawns mowed or being maintained, because you can sit on this property for a while before you do anything with it. I mean, it's your house. Technically, you can do what you want. But that wasn't included in the Ohio bill. And Senator Bill Blessing, who introduced it, actually said that's because home rule allows communities to do a lot of that stuff already.
Home rule, really?
That's what it says.
So okay. they're gonna rely on home rule for that one?
Yes.
Convenient, since they've kind of obliterated most home rule tips.
It was an
issues.
Odd number day and a full moon. And, one-eyed jacks were wild.
So how has that California law fared? Does it work?
It seems to be. I mean, it's very new. I think it's like a year old at this point. So we're still seeing the beginning of it. And what it is it doesn't ban these commercial investors outright, and neither would the Ohio law. It's like you said in the opening, it's what's called like a right of first refusal. So sometimes there are tenants living in the house. I'm sure we all remember from the Great Recession, people would get evicted and they're like, I've been paying my rent, mm-hmm. but their landlord wasn't paying the mortgage.
Right.
Which is awful. And so those are the people that get the first choice. If you are living in the house, you get first choice to buy it. And then the next would be somebody who wants to own or occupy, and you'd have to live there for about a year. So you can't like lie about it, theoretically, if that makes sense.
Right.
You have to live in it for at least a year. And then after that would be nonprofit housing partners.
Which there's a good example of that down in Cincinnati, right?
Yes. It's like R3D. I can't remember the exact acronym, but yes. Or like COHIO and those kinds of groups could purchase it. And then finally would be the investors. And it would be a 45-day waiting period.
What kind of support does the bill have? It is a Republican legislator, but...
He's optimistic that there'll be some bipartisan support. He thinks Democrats will get on board with this. But what he said is he recognizes, so there's like this gentleman's agreement in the Ohio legislature that if you introduce a bill before April 1st of the last year, so we have a 2-year legislative session. So if you introduce before April 1st of the second year, you get a hearing. And he did it after. So he sort of recognizes that he's like not entitled to anything. But he's optimistic that they'll get at least a couple of hearings. He said this is really about opening the conversation and seeing what folks are potentially open to. But he said he's heard like from Republicans, like generally speaking, that they think this is a problem, that the decline in home ownership is like a wealth building problem. And the devil is sort of in the details on this one, as in terms of like who will support it.
It's interesting. It comes today. And of course, you know, again, many of your listeners are very well aware of the challenges of home buying. And we all know what the Columbus market's been.
Right.
And interest rates and all that fun stuff. Kind of interesting timing. As we record this, we're a few hours away from HUD Secretary Marcia Fudge and Senator Sherrod Brown. I think the Congresswoman Joyce Beatty is at the event as well, to sort of unveil, if you will, the Biden administration's plan to help bring more affordable housing to communities like the Columbus area and, you know, places like this across the country. Well, not just places like Columbus, but more affordable housing across the country. So interesting. We have the sort of the federal angle, if you will, and as Anna described well, the state angle. But, you know, certainly people are hearing from their constituents about this, the big picture, this problem. It's like, you know, you don't like government until you want something done. It says, why aren't you doing anything?
Right. Age-old problem. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Daryl Rowland, senior editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Anna Staver, State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Ohio has a new superintendent of public instruction, former State Board of Education member Steve Dakin. It was not a unanimous choice. The vote was 14-4. Who opposed his selection, first of all?
There's a handful of more conservative members. on the board who wanted a more conservative candidate. So a lot, for listeners who aren't super familiar with the Board of Education, the statewide Board of Education, they have had some controversy in recent months. So they passed a resolution, an anti-racist resolution, in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. And it talked about lower outcomes, educational outcomes for black children.
This was back in 2020, yeah?
Yes. And then there was a lot of pushback. There were some people that said that this was opening the door to critical race theory in our schools, divisive concepts, all that stuff that we've been talking about in education for the last year. And so they voted to repeal it. And some of the members did not vote to repeal it. Those members were appointed by the governor. They were asked to resign. We got new members. During all of this, the state superintendent resigned himself and he left. And it's been kind of a lot of controversy. And so some of those more conservative members wanted somebody who was a little more aligned with them ideologically. So they voted against Dakin.
As far, just to be clear, Paolo Di Maria, he retired or resigned because of this? No.
He never said one way or the
right,
other,
okay,
but no.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So,
but the other
exactly
board members who resigned did so directly because of this.
Well, it was in the aftermath of all of this.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know if they said specifically.
Yes, it was board president Laura Kohler and Eric Poklar. And they resigned because the governor told them to, because they serve at the pleasure of the governor.
Okay.
And it was directly related to this vote to repeal the anti-racist resolution.
Which Mr. Dakin did support.
The repeal, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the what happened after his appointment was responses from a lot of different groups, including teachers' unions, charter school groups, Governor DeWine. And it seemed to be, the consensus seemed to be that they believe that Steve Dakin's going to be somebody who will focus on student achievement, focus on academic loss, performance loss through the pandemic. So maybe getting back to getting outside of those controversial topics and more back to academic achievement, academic performance. And so maybe we're seeing a shift in the tide when it comes to what the State Board of Education and what the Ohio Department of Education is going to be working on. But that seemed to be some of it. And the fact that it was a 14-4 decision instead of something a little more polarizing might be a reflection of that as well, too.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point. I think that, you know, learning loss from the pandemic, chronic absenteeism, declining test scores, these are big educational issues. And I mean, that could take up the next couple of years of their time.
Well, they are big educational issues, but Daryl Rowland, do you have faith that they can, I mean, these other issues are really what's driving people to, you know, get involved. I mean, this whole critical race theory, which, by the way, is a red herring. It's not being taught in the schools.
Well, it's interesting, the state school board. I guess I've been around enough. It seems like, I don't know, it's like the return of the
cyclical.
Yeah. The cicadas. It's not because it was not 17 years, for better or worse. But yeah, you know, whether it's evolution versus intelligent design, whether it's sex education, you know, every few years there's a big blow up on the State Board of Education.
Right.
And everyone says, wait, we have a State Board of Education? What do they do again? And then the controversy is whatever, dies down, and then they kind of, you know, crawl back in, and who knows what the next issue will be.
Now,
but yeah, you're absolutely right. That's the current issue. I mean, we've seen this is definitely a political talking point in this election. We saw it in the Virginia gubernatorial election. Certainly Jane Timken here in Ohio tried to make it a talking point in the U.S. Senate election. You know, you talk about parents and your kids and what education they're getting. You know, that is a near and dear subject. That is, I mean, there's no question it's important. It's just, the State Board of Education throughout the years has not been a very efficient policy-making group, certainly one where policies stick.
Right.
So in some ways, there's lots of heat and smoke, and nothing really changes that much. There may be a recommendation or whatever. I mean, we just had the big fight over the critical race theory. Well, what really changed out of all that? You know, just a big fight, and here we are. It's kind of the same.
The appointment of Steve Dakin wasn't without controversy, though. He led the search for the replacement, And then he applied the day before the deadline to apply. He applied a day before the deadline. What's he said about that, Anna?
He's been pretty quiet about it. He hasn't really granted interviews. He wasn't there at the board when he was appointed. I have been messaging the spokesperson for ODE repeatedly to just like sit down with him and talk about his new job. But basically what he and what the board and what the Ohio Ethics Commission has said to him is, they told him to resign immediately before applying because he couldn't be on the board while he was applying.
Which he did.
Yes, which he did. He followed their recommendation. But it is sort of a question of he resigned from his job at Columbus Community College in December, and he cited the board search as being the focus of his resignation. And then he got to look at all those applications from everybody. He got to shape what was going to be a priority. He was privy to all those discussions. And then he himself applied. And that's sort of the question was there an unfair advantage there because he saw what the he saw the other guy's homework.
Yeah, exactly. He saw the specs, you know, for what they were particularly looking for. And I guess, though, it's all okay?
They say so. And I talked with Senator Andrew Brenner about it, who kind of is very involved with the school board. He chairs the Senate Education Committee. And mm-hmm. he had said, you know, like that Dakin decided that he wanted to put his application in, that he resigned and that, you know, keep in mind that he was a finalist for the job in 2011. Mm-hmm. So this is something that's been on his mind for several years.
And he, you know, it's not like
he's not total, unqualified.
Yeah. I mean, he was superintendent for several years at the Reynoldsburg school system, set up a kind of a not unique, but a more unusual open enrollment program at a, you know, fairly large suburban district. He was well thought of, certainly by former Governor Kasich as well, put him on the school board. And then Governor DeWine reappointed him.
That project of his, you know, the open enrollment project at Reynoldsburg is considered a signal that he's, and correct me if I'm wrong, but sympathetic to vouchers and all of that. He's
at least generally to school choice. I mean, the school choice advocates, as Anna reported, were pleased with the appointment. So when we talk about the conservative school board members, I guess this shows how our political spectrum is. You know,
the really conservative ones opposed him, but the middle of the road,
seemed to support him.
Okay, did you want to say something?
No, okay. I was just going to add that, what Anna and Daryl said that. The optics are bad. He is qualified, and he was a finalist in 2011, but it's just the optics of it are bad.
Was he on the search committee in 2011?
I don't think he was on the board in 2011.
Okay.
When did Kasich first appoint him? That is a very in-the-weeds question.
Yeah.
I mean, Kasich just took office in 2011, so I don't think he would have had an opportunity yet.
Alrighty. Well, we'll move on. We'll take a break first. You're listening to our weekly reporter roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Anna Staver, Statehouse reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Daryl Rowland, senior editor with the Columbus Dispatch. There were protests over the weekend at the Statehouse over abortion. It's the second weekend in a row, actually. I guess there were well over 1,000 people over the weekend. What effect, if anything, does public protest have on the process these days, Daryl Rowland? Any thoughts?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure it really has much of a practical effect. I mean, we've been protesting this, you know, since almost 1973 mm-hmm. in this country, back and forth. And it's been one of those traditional lightning rod, third rail issues. remarkably, public polling, again, agree with the issue or not, but public polling shows that the majority in this country and in this state are pro-choice, if you will. Now, that's not...
With restrictions.
With restrictions, yes. And, you know, and then that's where it gets dicey, and that's what you see on both sides. It depends on how you slice those, you know. I mean, there's very few at the extremes. 100% like abortion till birth, and 100% no abortion for any cause. There are small minorities at either end of those. And that's what part of what makes this a tough issue, because the extremists, in some sense, like many issues, are dominating the debate, and that's not where most people are on this. But boy, this is to say this is an easy issue, and you know, this is, like I say, the last 50 years of our country, we've just turned ourselves inside out over this.
So we know that a majority of Ohioans support some access to abortion. It mostly has to do with the time frame of access to an abortion, right? Right now, it's the heartbeat bill is in abeyance at this point, but...
Yeah, so when you look at the numbers, like through the first trimester, up to about 13, 14 weeks, you get a solid majority support. And that, I would point out, is when the majority of Ohio abortions occur. I want to say at least 3/4 occur during that time frame. And then it is, as you get closer to what we call that edge of viability, support for abortion drops. But those cases also drop. Like, you're talking about a very small minority of abortions, and they're usually for very complex medical reasons. And, you know, I always like to point that out because the number of doctors in the country that perform abortions past 24 weeks, I think, is 4. There's 4. And they take no insurance, and it is $10,000, and you have to fly there yourself. And it is no payment plan.
This
payment
is without
upfront.
A medical reason. Other abortions are performed.
No, with past 24, 25 weeks, it is incredibly expensive, not covered by insurance. And there are only 4 doctors in the country who perform
it. All right.
I used to work in Colorado, where Dr. Hearn, one of those doctors resides, and I spent a few days with him as part of my reporting, and he takes it on a case-by-case basis. But he is $10,000 to $15,000 upfront, no insurance, no payments.
Wow.
And the law,
that's
right,
not there. That expensive, I mean, considering, but...
Yes, but it is, something to keep in mind, and that's why it's such a small percentage.
Yeah.
Because I think most of the time, by the time you get to 25, 30 weeks, these are children that most people want or had hoped to
have. Yes, and can't. Something's gone wrong. Yeah, Daryl?
And the current Ohio law is 20 weeks.
Yes.
And that's, you know, we talk about the heartbeat bill and all that. That has passed, been signed by the governor, but that's still, you know, on hold because of the court system. But the 20-week threshold is by law in Ohio right now.
Yes.
The question is then, all right, so these protests, what I observe them to be is a way to lather up, you know, the electorate, you know, and get them motivated. But I'm wondering, Andy, since it's an issue that's only really a small number of people vote strictly on the abortion issue and abortion access.
I wonder that. I would argue... I guess there's no real data to back this up, but I would argue that if you are a conservative who is against abortion, it might be, I think there might be more people who would say, if I'm a one issue voter, I'm an anti-abortion voter. But so you're saying on the flip end, if you're somebody on the abortion rights side, it might be a really big issue, but not your number one single issue vote. And I think that's what we're seeing in the results of these elections that we've seen over the past couple of years, statewide, locally. And I do wonder now that the I guess, for lack of a better word, threat of Roe v. Wade being overturned, I think we will really see how big of an issue is that on the other side for the abortion rights side. Do they go out and do they make their voice heard? And not to be the one to constantly bring up redistricting, but we do live in a state where if you do want to make your voice heard, you're probably voting in a district that already has a Democratic representative. And then you might not be getting the representation you want if you are in a district that tends to lean to the right, because those are districts that lean very far to the right, and you don't have to have a legislator who needs to be more accountable to the middle.
I do wonder, and maybe Andy can offer a comment too, but I wonder how it's going to play out in the governor's race, because mm-hmm. I think one of the things people have always said about Mike DeWine, especially in his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic in those early days, that he got a lot of bipartisan, sort of moderate, middle-of-the-road support for that. But he is very strongly pro-life. He signed the heartbeat bill where Governor Kasich did not.
Right.
He says he will sign a full ban. That's just who he is.
That's right.
And I sort of wonder if the leaked Supreme Court decision is real and becomes official, will those moderate middle of the road voters have a harder time voting for DeWine? If that might, because it's very different to talk about access past 20 weeks versus any access at all, even in the case of rape, which is what the proposed trigger ban does.
Well, and it all does come down to the states. If the Supreme Court overturns Roe, that means it's going to the states. And I'm wondering if it activates a new generation of voters, Daryl Rowland, who are turning 18 this year.
Well, and that's, Democrats are certainly hoping that. And they are, when we talk about political, and maybe this is, as you say, the rallies are sort of, fire up the base, if you will, or whatever. And, that certainly is
a reason
to have a protest, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But, you look at Sherrod Brown, you look at Mike DeWine's Democratic opponent, Nan Whaley. I mean, she criticized John Cranley in the primary because he used to be pro-life and then became pro-choice. So he wasn't like pure enough. I mean, this is kind of where we've gone on this issue in this country. It's, even recent converts are kind of not welcome in our purest camp, if you will. But now we have just about the starkest difference that you could have between the pro-life and the pro-choice camps. And I use those shorthands. I realize it's not AP style, but I think people know what
they
mean.
Who you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah. And, there's all sorts of questions here. There's been interesting commentary where, a lot of Republicans are not really saying a whole lot about
this. Yes, I know. Yes.
And someone said, well, this is like the dog has finally caught the car.
Yeah.
And they don't know quite what to do with it.
What about the issue of, I know, the dog that caught the car. It's so perfect. Anyone who has a dog. It seems like it's gotten more extreme. In Ohio and in many other red states, where before, now we have the heartbeat bill that's waiting, to be triggered and to, activated. State lawmakers are promising another of all-out ban, and it would not include exceptions for rape and incest.
Correct.
I mean, that 10 years ago would have been unthinkable, Andy Chow.
Yeah, and I think it does kind of show how we as a state have been moving towards polarized-wise I think it does go back to the makeup of the Ohio House and of the Ohio Senate, where the Republicans continue to build on their supermajority. So in order to move legislation forward, you need to get more of the backing of your Republican caucuses to be the speaker or to be committee members. And so it's just sort of the more power that one party gets in either chamber, the further right they will go with it. And so I think that's a reflection of that. We've had this discussion when it comes to anti-vax legislation, which used to be on the fringe 5 years ago and has now been a little more mainstream. So I think that is just kind of what we're seeing here in Ohio.
And it's fascinating. It's, Bill Clinton was the old safe, legal, and rare, that mantra.
Yeah.
And I forget who it was, but they just broke news. I think it was just last week. Democrats actually put out a new set of talking points. And we're not saying safe, legal, and rare anymore, Democrats. It's safe, legal, and accessible. So there's no even a nod to, abortion is something we think should be kept in law, but it's not necessarily something we want to encourage or, kind of a last resort, if you will. And now on the other side, the pro-life camp has often talked about, often been criticized for, you care about, as you call them, babies, pre-born babies, up until the point of birth, but then you oppose all these programs once they're born, healthcare and what have you. So I think the pressure's maybe on there. It's like, if you get what you want here, there's going to be a whole lot more babies, and they're going to need a whole lot more care. Are you going to be in this game? Again, but then pro-choice people say, pro-lifers should have to care for them all. Well, is that really the moral position, if it is a life? I don't know. Well, you can just, You can go on and on. This is complex.
Well, and we didn't even get to the disproportional impact it could have on low-income people.
Well, let's get to that. I mean, that's the point. Yeah, I mean, because even though California, I mean, some states are offering themselves up as, you know, I don't know what the word would be.
You don't want to use the word tourism, but I know what you're thinking.
Yeah, they're
like
offering
safe
to
harbor
help.
Safe harbor,
yeah.
That's a good
So my colleague Joe Ingles has done a lot of reporting on this. You can find it at statenews.org. I'm winking. And one of the reports that she's done is there's a report done by OSU researchers that found that if Ohio were to ban abortions, then where could you have access to abortion? It would be in other states, and you'd have to drive an average of at least 200, 300 miles to get there. That's money, gas money, staying in a hotel. There's a lot of financial impact.
And there's all kinds of restrictions about, you know, all the pre-restrictions that are already in place in so many states. I mean, in Ohio, it's not like you just show up at a clinic.
Right. And then you've got insurance restrictions of if you seek to have a procedure done out of state, does that change what happens when it comes to that? So,
And some companies are adding that now to their pool of benefits, that they're saying that they will pay for that for people in states where abortion is deemed illegal. We had a story today by our health reporter about that issue, about minorities being disproportionately impacted. And here's, again, why this issue is a little complex. Because this is, kind of from a pro-choice perspective, pointing out that, yeah, if you got to go out of state, basically anything that requires money is going to disproportionately affect the poor. Duh.
Yeah.
And people of color are disproportionately poor. So that equation is easy, to make. So it's bad. But flip side, the ardent pro-life people saying for years abortion is racist because it disproportionately affects people of the poor. There are more black, as they would put it, more black babies killed than there are babies not of color. So they're saying this is a good thing. This will help the black minority more and people of color. So there you go. Just, point, counterpoint, and it's like, I don't know how it's all going to end. I just,
I think, so I used to live in Colorado, as I mentioned earlier, and they, the Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains includes Colorado and New Mexico, which are states that allow abortion surrounded by states that heavily restrict abortion. So you're talking like Utah, Wyoming, Texas. These are like, and I will say that if you travel to those border clinics, those closest, in the morning, you will look out on a sea of out-of-state license plates. Like, I once talked to a woman who spent the night in her car to make it on time for her appointment. And so that is out, but it is a day off work. It is child care. If you look at the most likely woman to have an abortion in Ohio is a woman without a college degree, who's 20 to 29, who's probably a minority and has at least one child. And, I sort of ask, like, what if you ask yourself, why would she be having an abortion? And it is probably because she probably has a kid. She probably doesn't have a college degree. It's probably a question of, like, how am I going to manage this? And that is the question that pro-choice people ask. How is she going to manage that? Like, child care grants are incredibly complicated. WIC and food stamps and all of that stuff is like incredibly complicated to maneuver through. And, adding another human into this world as someone who has two tiny humans, it's a lot of work going from one to two.
I suspect that if they already have a child, they already know.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a theory. It's a fact. And they know it just already doesn't go far enough.
I mean, I would sure hope, Anne, that... And this is probably my idealistic pipe dream here, but at the end of the day, however this shakes out, can we really put children first, not just make that rhetoric? Can we just not make children a talking point here? Can we really, we have hundreds and hundreds of foster children right now in Ohio that can't, they're under the care of the state because we don't have enough foster parents. Mm-hmm. The waiting list for adoption, presumably this will mean more. Can we step, can pro-life and pro-choice, can they possibly put their differences aside just for this one issue? Say, I don't care. We can fight like dogs in this issue, but this kid is right here in front of us. This young boy, this young girl needs help, and we're going to work together to help them.
We have to call it there. Daryl Rowland, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
And if elected.
Thank you.
Daryl Rowland, senior editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Anna Staver, State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thanks to you as well.
Oh, thank you.
And Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Ann.
That's it for now. Thanks to everybody else out there listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.